coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, for the next hour, they're going to be the views of Mr. William Pepper, who really had the unique opportunity of taking a case to the federal courts dealing with the murder of Martin Luther King. Now, it's very difficult for the average American to realize that a major figure in America could be assassinated. There could be a trial that was held to determine who was responsible, and of course the decision was that in large part the federal government was responsible for the murder of Martin Luther King, and not a word of that get into the controlled media. But unfortunately, ladies and gentlemen, that is exactly what happened. But you don't want to hear my description. You want to hear from Mr. Pepper, who was there. Mr. Pepper, thank you very much for being with us today.
It's good to be with you.
Why don't you, Dillis, you give the background, and you go ahead and tell the story, and I'll try to be as quiet as I can, other than to say that your previous book, Orders to Kill, went up on the Internet today. There are only 5 copies of it. A number of them were quite expensive, and one was over $100. Only 5 copies of the book that you wrote, Orders to Kill, the story of the assassination of Martin Luther King. So, although we do have your new book, which we'll be offering at the end of the program, but we think it's so vitally important that people understand that there is really an organized effort to conceal this information. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes, I don't think there's any question that corporate mainstream media has not covered this case, as it has not covered, I'm sure, many other cases that deal with these kinds of situations.
All right, fine. Well, why don't you tell us how you got involved in this, and then what happened at the court?
Well, that's a long story. I don't know where you want me to begin. I was a journalist in Vietnam in 1966. And I didn't write anything when I was there. Took a lot of photographs, tape recorded continually, and was out in the country a fair amount of the time. In fact, most of the time I was there, I was away from what was then Saigon. Came back and did a piece for I did a number of pieces, but the main one that Martin King saw was done for Ramparts magazine, which was a California muckraking magazine published in San Francisco, and they did this article, which was the cover story lead article of theirs in January of 1967. Martin King saw it, saw the photographs, became distraught at what he saw and what he read, and asked to meet with me. We then formed a relationship that last year of his life. I had, like many others, had been down in the South off and on during the Civil Rights Movement, but had not known Dr. King and did not know him until that last year of his life. And he asked me to open my files to him, which I did, and at one point he openly wept when he saw the devastation that was being visited upon the people of that ancient culture. Most of the civilian population, of course, were children under the age of 15 years. So when he decided finally to come out forcefully against the war, he delivered a speech at Riverside Church on the 4th of April 1967, 1 year to the day before he was killed, and asked me to work with him to try to end this horrible war, and that horrible war, and to head an organization called the National Conference for New Politics, and that became an umbrella organization of the peace and justice movement at the time.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back.
Sure.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. William Pepper, who certainly was deeply involved in a litigation involving the death of Martin Luther King, the murder of Martin Luther King, the assassination of Martin Luther King. And Mr. Pepper was telling us that he had first certainly come into contact with Martin Luther King after he'd come back from the Vietnam War. He'd been over there as a over there taking pictures, and of course he had written an article that was published in a muckraking magazine in San Francisco, and Martin Luther King had seen that article and asked to meet with Mr. Pepper. And after he had seen the pictures of the devastation of what had happened in Vietnam at the hands of the American government. Why, of course, Martin Luther King asked Mr. Pepper to head an organization to try to end America's involvement in the Vietnam War. And, of course, what people don't understand is the people who are really running our government never intended to win the war over in Vietnam, but they certainly were not prepared to end the war in 1967. They wanted to drag it on and on and on, just the dragging on and on and on of the war that's going on in Iraq and Afghanistan today. So, Mr. Pepper, anyway, did you accept Martin Luther King's offer to head the organization?
Yes, I became executive director of the National Conference of New Politics, and we began about the business of building a broad-based coalition movement, indeed a third-party political movement that was geared toward having Martin King and Dr. Benjamin Spock as a ticket, a third-party ticket to run against Lyndon Johnson. At the same time, we formed a group called the Committee of Responsibility that brought over 100 war-injured Vietnamese children and spread them around the country in hospitals for restorative surgery in conjunction and cooperation with the Physicians for Social Responsibility out of Boston. So it was a multi-pronged effort, really, to try to alert the American population to the nature of this war, the horror of it, and what was going on. Well, long story short, of course, Martin King became convinced that ultimately, as well, he would have to take a step in direct action. And plan to massively mobilize a group of Americans to go into Washington and take up residence in the shadow of the Washington Memorial and visit their congressmen and senators on a daily basis. They talked about the possibility of bringing 500,000 people into Washington, taking up residence there.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mr. Pepper is telling us, of course, he had gone and done to work with Martin Luther King to try to get America out of Vietnam back in 1967. But, of course, there were very powerful forces at that time who had no intention of either winning the war or ending the war. They wanted the war for other purposes. And so, certainly, as Mr. Pepper and Martin Luther King worked together to bring children, wounded children from Vietnam over here, get them into hospitals. And Martin Luther King was planning on trying to get a massive march on Washington, D.C., and people to go to Washington, D.C., and contact their congressmen and try to bring pressure to end this the senseless Vietnam War, which our men were never allowed to win. So anyway, what happened at that point?
Well, it's important to understand that this was not just going to be a march. This was going to be an encampment. People were going to actually take up residence there in what became known or was to become known as Resurrection City. So it was unlike a march atmosphere where people would come and go. They were going to stay. Now, that was the problem that the military faced. There were two reasons, main reasons for the assassination of Martin King. One, his opposition to the war, which was building and growing in support throughout the country, and secondly, this potential civilian invasion of the nation's capital, because the military believed that Martin would lose control of that large mass of people, because the government was not going to put back into the budget the social programs it had taken out in order to fund the war. And that the army believed would incur a growing discontent, dissatisfaction, and anger on the part of that mass of humanity. and they could not, they didn't believe they had the troops to put it down, put down that that kind of insurrection that was going to result. So they didn't have, Westmoreland wanted 200,000 more in Vietnam. They didn't have them for him. So they certainly didn't have the troops stateside to put down that that growth, body of humanity that was going to be there. So I think the plan to, without Martin King, that encampment would not have the power or be the success that it would be with his leadership. So I think the decision was taken to eliminate him in the course of that 1967. He was then, of course, drawn into Memphis because of the sanitation workers' strike in early 1968. Reverend Lawson, a pastor and SCLC member in Memphis, convinced him to come in and become involved, and so he felt he should, because the wretchedly poor sanitation workers in Memphis needed that kind of support. So he got drawn into the Memphis sanitation workers' strike in early 1968, and that, of course, led to his death and his assassination at the Lorraine Motel on April 4th, 1968. He was killed with a single shot that was fired about 1 minute past six on that evening. Well, when Martin King was assassinated, that kind of did it for me in terms of politics. I'd lost all confidence in the system at that point in time. Wanted nothing more to do with it. We went to the memorial in Memphis, Dr. Spock and I, and then down to Atlanta for the funeral. Bob Kennedy invited us up to his suite, and I just refused to go. I had been Bob's citizens chairman in Westchester County, New York, when he ran for the Senate in 1964. But I'd had my fill of it. That was it. So I didn't go. I rather regret that now, because I think the Bob Kennedy I knew in 64 was not the Bob Kennedy who was assassinated in 1968. I think he had grown enormously. Anyway, I walked away from all of that. And leapfrogging 9 years into the future, Ralph Abernathy and I were speaking in 1977, and he asked me to go to the prison and interrogate James Earl Ray, who had been apprehended and had been charged with the crime, and had copped a plea at the insistence of his then counsel Percy Foreman, and was sentenced to 99 years. And Abernathy, I would be in touch with Abernathy and Hosea Williams and others in the movement from time to time, but Abernathy finally asked me to go up to Brushy Mountain Penitentiary and interview James. I thought he'd gone around the bed, and I said, "What?" We all thought they had the right guy. I said, "Ralph, you have some questions about this?" At this, 9 years later, almost 10 years later, and he said, "Well, I just would like you to interrogate him." I said, "Ralph, I don't know anything about the case. It could take me quite a while," which it did, to read and to learn about as much as I could about what had happened. So finally, in August of 78. We went to Brushy Mountain and interviewed James Earl Ray. I interrogated him for 5 hours, put him through a very stressful interview. And we came away deeply disturbed as a result of that five-hour session. We came away convinced that Ray was not the shooter. We didn't know what role he might have played in terms of involvement one way or another. We knew he wasn't the shooter. That became abundantly clear in the course of the interview. But it disturbed me because issues that he raised and questions that had been unanswered were troubling. Now, the House Select Committee on Assassinations, the Congressional Committee, was investigating both the John Kennedy and the Martin King assassinations. And I guess we hoped that the subcommittee of the King case would come out with a report that would answer a lot of the questions. And it did report out in 1979, early 79, but it didn't answer the any number of the leading questions. So I got annoyed enough that I started in 1978-79 going down into Memphis very quietly and began an investigation that has effectively gone on for nearly 30 years. James Earl Ray kept asking me to represent him. I refused. I refused for 10 years. Because I said to James, I have to be absolutely certain that you had no knowing role in the assassination of Martin King. And it took 10 years before I became totally convinced of that. And so I became James's lawyer in 1988. I was his counsel for the last 10 years of his life. We struggled mightily to get a trial for him. We failed. He ultimately died in prison. And in the course of that representation, and we took the case all the way to the Supreme Court where we were denied certiorari. Eventually, we decided to try a television trial. An unscripted television trial was run by HBO and Thames Television of the UK. Jury chosen from across the country. Independent retired federal judge heard the case, Marvin Frankel. Case was tried in Memphis over a period of 13 days in 1993, it was leading up to the 25th anniversary of the assassination. And Hickman Hewing was the former U.S. attorney in Memphis, was the prosecutor. And he would gleefully boast to me that he'd tried 200 cases, the criminal cases, and he'd not lost one. So I should know what I was in for in that case. And I was duly impressed. Well, we went to work, and we did a serious amount of investigative work, and we tried the case, and it took the jury 7.5 hours to find James Earl Ray not guilty. Now, they found him not guilty with a smattering of the evidence that eventually was the result. As a result, the consequence of that trial, people came forward from all over who had been quiet for all those years. And they started now to reveal evidence. So I began spending increasing amounts of time in Memphis, although I had moved my family to England many years before, and I was at Cambridge, and I was virtually commuting from Cambridge to Memphis and other parts of the South as I conducted this quiet investigation. And that went on and on and on, and it led finally to the book you referred to, Orders to Kill, which was the first work I did on the case. The second one, Act of State, summarized all of the early work, and then it took the readers through the history of the second trial. And the second trial resulted from my representing the King family against Lloyd Jowers, behind whose grill in the bushes was where the sniper shot Martin King. And so we sued Jowers and others, agents of the government of the United States, state of Tennessee, city of Memphis, known and unknown. And that was a massive trial. That trial went on in 1999 for 30 days, over 70 witnesses, under oath, in a civil court in Memphis, and never before in the history of political killings or assassinations has a detail been set forth in such specificity as happened at that trial, laying out how and why Martin King was assassinated.
And, of course, the amazing thing is that the media, there were people there apparently at the very beginning, and then the case was never covered. The media joined hands to suppress the information so that the average American has never heard about the second trial.
No, that's right. It was not covered. Court TV's counsel was a friend of mine at the time. He said, this is the most important case in my lifetime, so we're going to have our cameras there. Well, he was told by a senior management, no, you're not. Most of the media stayed in the hallway, except when celebrities testified, like Mrs. King and the King, members of the King family.
Hold that thought. We're going to be
Andrew
right back.
Young.
We're going to be right back in just a moment. Well, why don't you go right ahead, pick the story up from there. So you said that the media was out in the hallway, and people came, like Mrs. Martin Luther King, to testify. So pick the story up. And you were actually, were you representing the King family or what?
Yes, I was representing the King family in that trial. I was lead counsel for the King family against Lloyd Jowers and as we said, others. So I laid the case out, and over a period, it took 30 days and over 70 witnesses. It was a very dramatic setting, but was ignored by the media. There was a report, there was a scant report after the jury that took the jury 59 minutes to find that the King family was justified in alleging conspiracy. They found there was a conspiracy, effectively found that James Earl Ray was an unknowing patsy, and they attributed 70% of the blame on governmental agents, 30% to Mr. Jowers. We had boxed Jowers in. We had, by that time, gotten eyewitnesses and that saw him actually running into the back of his kitchen with his still-smoking rifle after Martin was shot and the sniper went down over the wall, ran north on Mulberry Street to the next corner and was picked up by a Memphis Police Department traffic car and driven away. So this is the kind of detail that we were able to put forward.
Well, no. What was the relationship between Jowers and this other man that was picked up by the Memphis Police Department?
They were co-conspirators.
All right.
The planning for the assassination, the final logistical planning, took place in Jowers' Grill. It was a place called Jim's Grill.
And it was right across the street from the motel where Martin Luther King was killed.
It backed onto Jim's Grill. Was in the ground floor of a rooming house that backed onto the Lorraine Motel. And James, who had been controlled throughout the time that he was on the run from prison, remember, James was an escaped convict who escaped from prison.
This is James Earl Ray you're speaking of.
James Earl Ray, yeah. He had been handled by a man called Raoul. And most people in official circles laughed that James had a handler called Raoul, and thought he made up this character. Well, of course, Raoul was a very real person and did handle him and did control him. And he met James there in Jim's Grill on the afternoon of the 4th of April, 1968. And James was told to rent a room in the rooming house, which he did. And then he brought his stuff up there, left it, and was told to basically to stay out of there most of the afternoon. And that room was the really was the logistical center for carrying out of the assassination, which took place in the, as I said, in the bushes behind Jim's Grill. Those bushes were destroyed the next morning. The Public Works Department, under the supervision of the police, totally destroyed that area, cut down all the bushes, and made it appear that there was no place that a sniper could hide.
Well, no, did you ever talk to Mr. Jowers? Did he ever actually appear in court?
Oh, Jowers was in court. Of course he was in court.
Hold
he
that
broke
thought. We'll,
Jowers
hold
down.
That thought. Hold
Jowers.
On. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Mr. Pepper was simply pointing out that eventually the trial was held, and, of course, the jury found that Mr. Jowers, who was one of the trigger men, was 30% responsible, and the remainder, of course, involved the government at various levels, local government and the federal government. And of course, not a word of this got into the press. I mean, how could you let the American people know that the American government was involved in the murder of Martin Luther King? And so, certainly, James Earl Ray was there, but he was a patsy. He was like Lee Harvey Oswald. We had to have a patsy, somebody you could blame the assassination on. And I was just asking Mr. Pepper about Jowers. Now, Jowers was one of the trigger men, one of the assassins. And was saying that he actually appeared. He was actually called to appear in court.
Chalmers was sued by the family. He was not his role was not he was not the pro. He was not the sniper.
I see. He
his
just
role
had
was
the gun.
To take the gun from the sniper, bring it inside, break it down, and keep it until it was picked up and taken away. That was Jowers' role. A woman who had been his mistress, who kept the secret since 1968, saw him coming in through the back door into the kitchen of the grill with the rifle still smoking. And she finally told me that story in 1992 as we were preparing for the trial. 24 years later, she'd kept that secret all of that time. She was terrified in some ways, but she also was afraid that Jowers himself was the shooter, and she had mixed feelings about putting him in a situation where he would go to prison. So all of the evidence unfolded step by step, and it's a very sad story indeed. And the media did not cover it, and it was blocked out. There was the odd story would appear immediately the day after the trial announcing that there had been a verdict in a civil trial for the King family, but then it just disappeared. No one knew about it, and no one saw it, and we actually filmed the trial, so we have a film of it, and some folks are putting that on YouTube, are putting my closing argument, I believe, on YouTube now, or it's being circulated somewhat. At this point in time, but basically, mainstream America doesn't even know that this trial took place.
And I think that is one of the most amazing things. How could you possibly cover up, you know, a trial dealing with the assassination of Martin Luther King, where the jury felt that the government was primarily responsible? How could that happen in America, where we have freedom of the press, unless maybe we don't have freedom of the press, and where there is a control over the media, and ultimately then over what the American people hear, read, see, and ultimately believe.
I think that's right. I think there is a corporate control over the American media, and very often the corporate owners of the mainstream media institutions have diversified holdings, and they're. Consumerism is a driving engine of American society, and if people are anxious or worried or troubled, they lose confidence in their government. They're less likely to be as loose and as easy and as free to consume the goods of the society. It's a strange phenomenon, but it's true. So people have to be encouraged to believe government, to trust government, and the media is a major factor in the formation of people's opinions, of course, and a case like the King case is one that would be very unsettling if the truth got out.
Well, of course, how did the King family feel after the jury verdict came in? Would they feel vindicated, at least bringing out the fact that the government was responsible for the murder of Martin Luther King?
Yes, I think the family, without doubt, feels and has felt that vindicated. They believe that they found closure. They basically know what happened, and they supported James Earl Ray in his final years. I mean, you may or may not know, I arranged a meeting between Dexter King and James. And the family came to believe that a trial for James was necessary, and they did everything they could to try to bring that about. And the closest we came to it, of course, was the civil trial. I decided to move in the direction of a civil trial and convince them that this was the way to go, because we could never get there through the criminal justice system.
And, of course, it really went, of course, to... Now, are you speaking of the second trial or the first trial as the civil trial?
The civil trial was the second trial in 1999.
Hold that thought.
First trial was a trial for television.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is William Pepper. We're talking about the trial that was held, the civil trial that was held, the second trial. What was that, 1999?
Yes, that's right.
1999. Now, what about Mr. Jowers? What did he have to say when he was certainly in the witness stand?
Well, Jowers was ill. He didn't take the stand, and eventually, toward the end of the trial, he was even confined to bed. But Jowers, under oath, and in sessions with Andrew Young and Dexter King and myself, laid out the whole scenario as far as he knew it. What he knew was that he was paid quite a large sum of money to allow his premises to be used for the planning and the carrying out of the assassination. He was approached by a man called Frank Liberto, who was a Marcello lieutenant in Carlos Marcello lieutenant in Memphis.
Is that the mafia?
Yes, the mafia.
Oh, okay, fine.
And the mafia fellow Liberto approached Jowers and got him involved in it, and was very much tied into the Memphis Police Department. And was able to exert great influence over their functioning. Marcello took the contract for the killing of Martin King, and it was carried out. It was effectively a mob hit, and a professional sniper hit Martin King. But what is really shocking, and why they had to kill this story, was that there was a military sniper unit in Memphis. An eight-man Alpha 184 unit was in Memphis, as in my view, solely as a backup. They did not kill Martin King, but they were ready. They had two snipers and two spotters in that group, and Martin King was a target, as was Andrew Young. And they were prepared, if the civilian sniper didn't do the job, they were prepared to take care of Martin King themselves. There was no way Martin was going to be allowed to leave Memphis and bring that mob of people into Washington, D.C., into the nation's capital. He was not going to be allowed to leave there alive.
And, of course, how were you able to find out about the military team, the snipers there? Did somebody come forward and tell you that story as well?
Well, what happened was a journalist for the Memphis Commercial Appeal spent 18 months researching the role of military intelligence.
Hold that thought. We're going to have to bring it. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, Mr. Pepper tells us that certainly Jowers, who is the man who ran Jim's Bar and Grill across the street from the motel, eventually admitted what had happened. He'd been paid a great deal of money to actually, of course, allow his premises to be used for the planning of the assassination of Martin Luther King. The man who put up the money was from the local mafia. And, of course, as those of you who do not know, but the mafia is used in the United States to carry out hits routinely. They're employed by the CIA. And if you doubt that, wonderful book called Double Cross, written by the brother of the head of the mafia many years ago, a man named Sam Giancano's brother, Chuck Giancano, wrote Double Cross. You can still get the book. And he tells you how the mafia does the hits for the CIA. So Jowers, of course, was the man who was seen coming in the back door of his place of establishment, his business, with a smoking gun. And he was seen by his mistress, who later, in the early 1990s, told Mr. Pepper the story of what had happened. Under any circumstances, when confronted with this lawsuit against him, Mr. Jowers told William Pepper that he had been paid so his facilities could be used, so he would take the gun from the sniper, and the sniper could get away. But Mr. Pepper was also pointing out that there were two military teams there with snipers, and if the mafia hitman certainly were to miss, why, of course, the military snipers were prepared to finish off Martin Luther King, because they could not allow him to leave Memphis alive and then lead this march on Washington, D.C. that might get out of control. And so you were telling me how you were able actually to learn about these two teams of military snipers. Would you like to just pick up the story there?
Yeah, well, a reporter, an investigative reporter for the Memphis Commercial Appeal, did an 18-month investigation of the role of military intelligence and surveillance on civil rights leaders and black leaders going back into the second decade of the 20th century. That's how far back. The Army was very concerned about the role of black leaders and the possibility that the American black population, then Negro population, could be influenced by the Russian Revolution, which you call took place in 1917, and so they put them under surveillance. Well, this reporter followed that all the way through, and eventually did a piece, a long piece, in the Memphis Commercial Appeal. I think it appeared in March 1993, as I recall, and that piece had a tiny paragraph in it, which indicated that there was an eight-man Alpha 184 Special Forces unit in Memphis on the day of the assassination, and no one had ever explained what they were doing there and why they were there. Well, when I saw that, I felt I really needed to get to the bottom of that, so I went to see this journalist, and I banged away at him, and he was very reluctant to get involved again. He said, these are very nasty people, didn't want anything to do with them, and I finally convinced him to be a liaison from me to some of the surviving members of that unit who had fled the country and who were living in Mexico.
In other words, they were fearful for their lives?
Yeah, I that was the impression I had, that they had fled because they were afraid they were going to be taken out, and they were in Mexico. So we conducted this long, they would meet with me because I was James Earl Ray's lawyer, and but they would answer my questions. Now, this journalist knew nothing really about the details of the assassination, so I would put together long narrative questions. He would take them to the people. They would meet they would agree to meet if we paid their expenses, gave them a small gratuity for their time, paid their expenses, and this went on back and forth for quite a long period of time. And so I began to get all the information as to how this unit functioned and how it was formed and what its role was. They were shown photographs of Andrew Young and Martin King at a briefing that started, I believe, at 4:30 in the morning at Camp Shelby. At Camp Shelby was where the briefing took place, where they were stationed. They then moved by cars into Memphis, into their various positions. They were in a triangular, the two snipers were in triangular situation. Anyway, all those details came out. All those details eventually emerged. And what emerged beyond that was the fact that there was a psychological operations unit on top of the fire station, which overlooked the Lorraine Motel, the parking lot, and the bushes. And it became evident to us that the photographers were put on top of that fire station, who filmed, took still film photographs of everything, also caught the sniper on film. And they saw the sniper lowering his rifle. We negotiated with one of those photographers for the better part of 2 years, tried to buy. He kept a set of the prints. He took up residence in Costa Rica, kept a set of the prints. We tried very hard to negotiate the purchase of those, and that was blown when my journalist intermediary used his real name going into Miami for a meeting, and he was on a watch list at that point, as were we all, and he was followed from the airport to the meeting site and by the FBI, and one of the agents stuck a camera out the passenger side of the door of their car some distance away, and it was evident to the psychological operations officer that he was there being photographed, that he just panicked and fled and wouldn't deal with us again. So we didn't get the photographs. But it was a very well orchestrated operation, and the reason for the photographers was to take blanket photographs of everything that was going on at the time of the killing. Photographers didn't know there was going to be a killing. These people were only told what they need to know. They didn't know there was going to be a killing, but they were told to photograph everything always. And as they, because then they, people looking at the photographs could see if anyone saw something they shouldn't have seen, they might have a problem. So it was an intelligence operation.
Well, it's just sort of like what happened with the murder of President Kennedy. There were over 100, 150, and 120 people who knew something about one or another aspect of the assassination, were all subsequently died very, very shortly after the assassination. So obviously they didn't want to have that same sort of thing happen with the murder of Martin Luther King.
Yeah, it was very well organized. It was controlled from a unit in the bowels of the Pentagon, the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, which is the only MIG that is based in Washington. I'm sorry, at the Pentagon, under the control of the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence.
Well, of course, the trouble is, of course, when you do these hit jobs for the government, and then, of course, they've got to silence you. And, if you're involved in any way, they're going to come after you and get you one way or another. I mean, they certainly have long tentacles every place in the world. I'm surprised these fellows were able to survive in Mexico.
Well, they survived. They got away, and they survived. They were left alone. It was thought that they did this in the 70s now, and I didn't get to them. Remember, I didn't get to them until 20 years later. So it was, although someone in 1979 told me that there were these people offshore and would I like to meet with them and could he possibly arrange it, and he wanted quite a sum of money, and this was a very difficult and expensive investigation, involved a lot of borrowing on my part and a lot of expenditures. I took out two mortgages on my home in England in order to fund this, and spent over $1 million of my own money over a period of 25 years. It's got to be a very slippery slope, and you just start down it, and you just, whatever reason, you just don't stop. And that's the reason we prevailed, is because I was able to just hang in there and follow it through. Because if I hadn't done that, we never would have had the information from people like Jowers, who years later, when he was dying and evidence was mounting against him and he wanted to clear his conscience to the extent that he could before he died. He since has died, of course. If you just walk away from this, these things are never heard of again, and you don't get the truth, and that's what happens, I believe, in most cases of this sort.
Well, I'm so glad that you did persist, even at great expense and even danger to yourself. But, I'm hoping that we can get this information out through Radio Liberty. We have listeners across the country, and I hope many of them will want to get copies of this tape, or we're going to put together a four-tape set on this, and hopefully why we can get the information out, because if they can murder somebody like Martin Luther King, and then have a national holiday. I mean, you have to have a lot of chutzpah to kill somebody and then a national holiday in their honor. But, of course, it's so incredible. Most people just cannot believe this story. Have you run into that? As you certainly have laid the story out to some people, they say it just couldn't be true. I refuse to believe it.
Yeah, I mean, there are people who simply do not want to believe it because they identify with our government and as being an authority of integrity and honesty and filled with all kinds of good guys. I think the Americans are the least sophisticated of any of the Western nations with respect to political operations and how governments function. I mean, I've got a great deal of support and understanding and in England than in Europe than I than I have ever been able to get in the United States, because people really do not want to believe this about their government. And the educational system in America is determined to dumb down the citizens in a very serious way, so that they are just not politically aware of the reality of the system.
And, of course, I think it's so vitally important that there are people like you who have the tenacity to follow through. I respect you for having gotten the material together and of course, for making it available to us. Are you getting many calls from the talk show hosts and others to tell the story?
Well, I don't know about many, but certainly some stations like yours who do a great national service. You know, alternative media to some extent wants to cover this, but even in the alternative media, frankly, there are gatekeepers, and people are not always willing to have the story out there. I mean, I have been canceled on National Public Radio in the past because they just had second thoughts about it. I have friends in major media companies in this country, and I've known off and on over the years. There's a great deal of respect for the work that I've done, but they will say to me, Bill, it's just not worth our job, you know, not worth my job to put this out there, because that's what it would amount to. So it gets to be very difficult. You know, Carl Bernstein taught us many years ago that the agency has over 400 people then, this was back in the 70s, has over 400 people in major media corporations across the country.
In other words, these are people planted as journalists,
yes,
or editors, or within the media,
yes,
of their CIA employees,
yes,
and they're there as gatekeepers.
Yes, that's right. They filter. And in Bernstein specifically said the New York Times, for example, had 12. That Sulzberger, old man Sulzberger, gave Alan Dulles 12 slots on the Times back in 1959. Now, I've been able to identify some of these people. Obviously, they rotate them over a period of time. But the agency is very well connected and is probably the largest publishing operation in the world, because it owns, in addition to infiltrating, it owns a number of media institutions in the United States and abroad, in particular abroad. So there's a great deal of effort to control public opinion, and that's why alternative media is still very, very important in terms of cases of this sort.
In fact, there's a book written by Lieutenant General William Odom, who was the head of NSA, and he wrote a book called Fixing Intelligence that came out last in 2003. And, of course, he is, of course, sworn to secrecy. He can't tell you what's going on, but he could ask questions like, should the CIA be assassinating people? Should the CIA have journalists planted in the American media? Should the CIA have a journalist planted in the American media? And, of course, that's exactly what you're saying that Bernstein had said, and I believe it's absolutely true. It's just so hard for the average American to realize the degree of organization that they have to control what we hear, what we see, what we
read. Oh, yeah, I can give you instance after instance after instance. I can, you know, fill your airways with anecdotes. I remember 67 when my piece came out in Ramparts, and Martin was interested in supporting it, that I was brought to Look magazine by associate editor named Chandler Broussard. He set up a meeting with Bill Atwood, and was the managing editor of Look at the time. And Atwood and I met for about 5 or 6 hours. And before we started the meeting, he said, I want to tell you a story. Bill, I said, yes, what's that? He said, well, you know, I got a visitor last week. I said, you did? Who is that? He said, Averell Harriman. I said, oh, Governor Harriman came to see you. He said, yes. He said, he came in to see me, and he said he brought me greetings from the President of the United States. And he said the President would be very grateful if I would do him a favor. And I said, what was the favor? The favor was that I was never to publish anything that Bill Pepper wrote. So I said, what did you say to him? And he said, I told him, well, that's interesting. I said, but you know something, I'm going to interview this young man. If I believe what he's saying is true, then we're going to publish him. Oh, by the way, give the President my regards.
And, of course, Look magazine isn't around anymore.
Well, what happened, of course, was that Chandler, the next week, Bill Atwood was, you know, this is the end of an era. Bill Atwood next week met with Jim Garrison, the DA from New Orleans. And that meeting went on into dinner and ended around midnight or nearly 1 in the morning, as Garrison laid out his John Kennedy's assassination scenario. And Atwood called Bob at 1 o'clock in the morning, Bob Kennedy. And he said, you know, I've just been shaken in my boots by what the Attorney General, District Attorney in New Orleans just told me about the killing of your brother. Bob's response reportedly was, yes, we know, but I have to get the White House first.
And that's why they had to kill Bobby Kennedy. Oh, hang on,
we'll be back. Well, the end of that story was...
Hold that thought just a moment. What's the rest of the story?
The end of that story was 3 hours later, Bill Atwood had a heart attack.
Oh, I see.
Left Look magazine and never to return as managing editor. Chandler Brassard was fired, and neither my story or Garrison's story appeared in Look. So, I mean, this is what you face. I face, you know, Rupert Murdoch won the auction for Orders to Kill, first book. HarperCollins won the auction. And at the last minute, Murdoch came in through the president, HarperCollins, and demanded that I take out the chapter on the military. And they said they'd make me a millionaire, and of course this was a Bob killing, and we all knew that now. And so I didn't really need to even involve the military. And I said, well, it was so linked together because they were working hand in glove here that it's very impossible to take it out. He said, well, you have to do it. And I said, why do you want it out? Well, we've got a problem with the FCC, with multiple entities and jurisdictions. So I've got a licensing problem. I've got an IRS capital gains problem. They just take it over Fox Studios. And so we've got these problems. We cannot afford to get the government angry with us. You've got to do it. And I ultimately refused to do it. Then, of course, the book went to a very small house, which had no clout or no backing or no money. And yet, Christopher Lehman Haupt of the New York Times was going to do a review in November of 1995, and he was told to pull it by his supervising editor. And he said it was the first time 25 years he'd been told to pull a review of a book.
And that, of course, was your book, Orders to Kill.
Orders to Kill.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is tragically the way the world really works. I think it's so difficult for me. I know it was so difficult 45 years ago when I was just a young doctor in practice, and I suddenly realized that the media was controlled, and why it was just like the whole house of cards that I believed in just didn't exist anymore. And I think it's a long, hard job, but we have listeners out all across America who are hearing the truth, and certainly I appreciate so very much your taking the time to be with us. And it's been a fascinating story, and I do hope that we can reduplicate this story. We'll put it onto tapes. We'll put it onto CDs. We'll get it out to everyone we can think of, because I think you've done a yeoman's job in the search of truth.
Well, thank you. Act of State is coming out in paperback form, and there is an epilogue attached to it. So, I mean, the whole trial is covered, so people could see all the evidence. Over 2,000 pages of transcript summarizes of evidence and testimony. It's all there, so if anyone is really interested, they want to see how government functions, please.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, our guest has been Mr. William Pepper. His book of the Act of State, and actually we got our supply in just yesterday, and I thought we were going to get Orders to Kill, but Orders to Kill is out of print at the present time. And is that going to come back into print or not?
No, I think not. Act of State is the final work, but there will be a third book on this case, which is the end of the story because of new evidence that's come out. But the paperback of Act of State will be coming out now, and then third book probably within the next year.
We actually have the book. We have copies available right now, and I'm going to tell our listeners how to get it. God bless you. Thank you so very, very much for being our guest this afternoon.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye. All right, fine. Well, I hope our listeners have enjoyed the interview. You see, this is how the world really works. And, of course, we're indebted to Mr. Pepper for risking his life and his family and spending over $1 million in research to bring us this book. And, of course, the book is entitled An Act of State. It's available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get a copy of an audio tape or of a CD of this program, they'll be available from Radio Liberty. And we do hope to put together a four-tape set on this subject that we want you to copy and get out across America. Because if they can kill Martin Luther King and then have the hypocrisy to name a day after him, a national holiday in the name of a man that were killed. Now, we have to understand that most people that work for government are good people, but there is a dark side. And this, of course, works certainly within the compartmentalized CIA. Most members of the CIA don't understand that they use the mafia to kill people. And if you doubt that, the book is Double Cross by Chuck Giancano, the brother of the head of the mafia, and he tells you how they killed Kennedy, President Kennedy, how they killed people throughout the rest of the world, how, of course, our government hires people to be assassins. And if you doubt that, why, of course, I suggest the book by Lieutenant General William Odom, which we do not carry. It's called Fixing Intelligence, where he simply asks the question, should the CIA be assassinating people? And the answer is, of course, they should not, but they are, and they assassinate them today. And I've had at least three CIA assassins who I've interviewed, and three of the people I've interviewed have been subsequently assassinated. Understand, ladies and gentlemen, that the world is not as you believe it is. There are dark and sinister forces, and behind that, the forces of truly Luciferian activity in the world today. And if you haven't heard my talk on the Forbidden Secret, you need to get it. You need, of course, to read my book or watch the DVD on the Brotherhood of Darkness. You need to get the four-tape set on the supernatural, four-tape or four-CD set. You need to get the four-CD or four-tape set on the Satanic Crimes and the book that goes with that. It will take you into the Bilderbergers, one of the most powerful groups that dominates America today. And behind everything going on are powerful spiritual forces. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And, of course, you go to our website at radioliberty.com. You can listen to our programs there live. You can listen to them archived. You can listen to them, on the MP3. We want to notify you that we'll be changing our evening shortwave frequency. And, of course, that's the program here at 8 to 9 here on the Pacific Coast and 11 to 12 on the East Coast to two frequencies. One is 5.875, or 6.110. 6.110 we change on the 31st of March. So if you listen to our programs on shortwave, that's how you'll be able to get the evening program. We'll get you the frequencies for the program you're listening to now. Remember, of course, we have to have shortwave and internet and satellite hookups. It's inexpensive. If you can help us, we'd appreciate it. But we ask you to pray for America, to pray for revival, but to please pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so until tomorrow, may the Lord be with you.